Thanks for the introduction. So I want to talk about work that's been going on in my life for the past few years, and feel free to interrupt if you have questions. So I think this is one of the problems that most people are interested in, is trying to understand how the external world is represented in the brain, how it's converted into action potentials, basically. And usual way of studying this is to put an electrode in your organism of choice and then present a stimulus and record the action potentials. Then what you do next is you change the stimulus, and then you document the associated changes in the firing of the cell. And you do this enough times, and ideally what you would get is some sort of input-output function, when it's a stimulus and this is a response. So it sounds simple in theory, but in practice it's quite complicated. And the problem is that the firing properties of cells are quite heterogeneous. And in many cases, it's very difficult to relate it to the stimulus. So I'm just going to show you some data from the auditory cortex, which is the region of the brain that I'm interested in. And what they did here was to record from a CAD cortex and then present tones of different frequencies. And they found some cells that behave in a way that you might expect, is that if you increase tone intensity, you get a monotonic increase in the response of the cell. Unfortunately, there are other cells that behave kind of strangely, whereas when you increase intensity, now you see a non-monotonic response. So the firing initially increases, but then decreases. And then if you look at the tuning curves, it can also be quite diverse. And what they did here was to present tones of different frequencies and intensities. And this area here, this darkened area, represents the where in the stimulus space that they were able to evoke a response. And so in some cells, the tuning curve is V-shaped, and in some cells, the tuning curve is enclosed. And then some cells exhibit something called two-tone suppression, where this dark line is the excitatory tuning curve derived in this way. And then this gray area is when they presented the second tone. In this gray area, they were able to inhibit the response to the first tone. And so it's called sideband inhibition because it tends to occur. It tends to flank the excitatory region. Anyway, some cells showed two of these sidebands. Others show one. Others show none. So it's quite heterogeneous. And then if you look at the firing patterns, it's also quite diverse. So in some cases, cells fire tonically for the duration of the stimulus. And in other cases, they fire only phasically at the onset. And so the intriguing thing about these responses is that these are presumably in the same area of cortex. And the stimulus is very similar. It's just a tone. But you get these very diverse response properties. And the question is, how does this occur? Is it through different circuits? Well, if it's through different circuits, then there's a big problem. It's like, how do you multiplex these into the cortex and still maintain its unique firing properties? And similarly, if it's because of the inputs are different, but you have the same problems, how do you keep the inputs segregated to maintain these firing properties? And one of the important determinants of these firing patterns is the relation between excitation and inhibition. And this is, you can't see it, this is recordings by Volkov and Galashuk back in 1991. And they performed intercellular recordings in auditory cortex, and then they applied stimulus, a different stimuli, and recorded the membrane potential. So in this case, they applied a tone here, and this trapezoid here represents the envelope of the tone. And if the tone was low intensity, they see mainly an EPSP. And then as they increase the tone intensity, you see an EPSP and IPSP. And with very large intensities, the IPSPs dominate. Okay, so there's a differential change in the EPSPs and IPSPs. In this case, they maintain the constant intensity and just change the frequency of the stimulus. So this is the cell's characteristic frequency. 14 kilohertz, you can see an EPSP and IPSP. And then as they moved away from the cell's best frequency, you can see the inhibition start to disappear. And then in this case, they just changed the slope of the envelope. So when the slope here was very steep, you see excitation followed by inhibition. And then when it's very, very shallow, you see mainly inhibition. And then if you look at the cells that tend to fire phasically, you can see a clear inhibition in the potentials. And then cells that fire tonically, it's mainly dominated by excitation. Okay, so it's this interplay of excitation and inhibition that really affects the way the cell responds to the input. And one can imagine that if you're recording from a cell in this large network, this receives inputs from the local inhibitory cells. And now when you present a stimulus, this activates several pathways. And then ultimately, it activates thalamic afferents, which then maybe activates neurons within a certain region. Okay, so then this would activate cells within the circle. And then as you increase the intensity, you might either increase the discharge rate of the activated inhibitory cells, or alternatively, you may activate a larger region of the cortical space. Okay, so depending on how these inhibitions scale, you might get the following, where if you increase the stimulus, inhibitory and excitation may co-vary, and the sum is monotonic, and so the firing rate might be monotonic. In some cases, maybe inhibition is activated later and to a greater extent, and this would produce a non-monotonic response in firing the cells. Okay. So one of the goals then of the study is try to determine exactly how this inhibition and excitation scale as you change the input. And to get a feel for how this might occur, we can consider two major configurations that's been proposed in the literature. And one of them is the co-tuned, or CON. So one might imagine there's a primal cell here in cortex, and then it receives an afferent from the thalamus and kind of spreads out in cortical space like that. And this activates the inhibitory cell as well as the primal cell. Okay, so this is a source of excitation and this is a source of inhibition. And let's say in this scenario, the width of the axonal spread of the thalamus and the interneuron are about the same. And if you activate a population of thalamic afferents, it would activate also the interneurons. And in this case, you also activate these cells here, but they don't contribute anything to the inhibition because the axon aberrations are fairly short. So in this scenario, if you were to map out the excitation and inhibition, they have comparable widths. Okay, and this is why it's called a co-tuned. The other scenario is that the inhibitory axons are relatively broader than the thalamic afferents. And now when you activate a population of thalamic inputs, you can these cells here will contribute to the inhibition into that pyramidal cell. And now the inhibition profile will be broader than the excitation. So now you have I don't know if you can see it, a classical Mexican hat synaptic profile. And these produce very distinct sets of responses. And there's been a lot of studies recently in vivo to determine exactly which one of these configurations are present in cortex. And most of the studies so far suggest that excitation and inhibition are co-tuned, although one of these groups are softening their stance a bit and suggest that maybe lateral inhibition is also present. David?
Are you committed to all of this being feed-forward?
I'll show you why it's probably feed-forward, mostly feed-forward, at least for the thalamic inputs in layer 4. Okay, so the goals of the study then, oh, sorry. And then, but the like I said, these produce very distinct sets of responses. And we did a lot of simulations, and we showed that about half of the response properties of cortex can be accounted for by code-tuned networks. But then the other half, we really need lateral inhibition. So for example, these monotonic rate level functions can be reproduced with a code-tuned, but these non-monotonic, you really need lateral inhibition. Similarly, this V-shaped tuning curve can be reproduced with code-tuned, but these enclosed ones, you need lateral inhibition. And then these sideband inhibition, it's kind of obvious, you need the lateral inhibitory circuits. It can't be reproduced with the code-tuned.
Oh, sorry, the inhibition is in space while the octaves are in slightly different units.
Yeah, I'm assuming that the it's tonotopic axis, so I can convert this distance in space into frequency space.
So tonotopic in micrometers?
Yes, yeah.
Wouldn't that predict that lateral tones by themselves actually influence the activity of the cell because they inhibit? In two-tone suppression, you have an interaction between the two tones, right?
Yeah.
You need this interaction to see something, to see the effect of the surround.
Right.
And here you're claiming that the surround is directly inhibiting. So actually, you don't need the center tone. And in principle,
well, it depends on where you. If you just activate it here, and this character's frequency with one tone, the excitation would dominate. So if you present another tone here, one here and another one here, then inhibition will.
But if you present only one tone in the surround, then it should inhibit the cell.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's like part of its receptive field. It's not surround suppression or something like that.
But again, it's not.
It's not surround suppression. It's okay.
No, I mean there's different solutions to this. The one I showed you was cortical. It might also be that the tuning properties of the inhibitory cells are broader than the excitation. Okay, so if both of these circuits are necessary, again, like the question is for us is how do you put this into the same cortical area? Okay. It's you have a limited number of interneurons, it's like 10%, and so there's got to be some slop in the these circuits have to share the interneurons, and it's kind of a interesting problem. And so the way we approach this was twofold. One is we do the experiments, and this is in the slice recordings, and we try to figure out the patterns of connections between the excitatory cells and the inhibitory cells. So we characterize the synaptic strengths and the dynamics. and then we incorporate these measured parameters into simulations. It's a huge network. And basically the result of this simulation is the main message here. Is that the same cortical circuitry produces both the LIN and CLN. I mention this now because there's a good chance we won't get there, knowing this audience.
So what's different under the two cases?
I'll show you. Okay. And then...
even though we don't, won't get there.
What's that?
Even though we won't get there?
Oh, we'll get there. Sure. And then in the step that's very painful for experimentalists, we're going to reduce the network. We're going to throw away a lot of the data that we spent many months collecting because it's really not necessary. And then we're going to try to reconstruct some of the response patterns that's been observed in vivo. And then if we have time, we're going to discuss the functional implications. Okay. All right, so this is the experimental paradigm. We take a mouse cortex, and if you slice it at the right angle, you can have both the auditory cortex and the thalamus, the medial geniculate, and the interconnecting fibers. And then we do recordings mainly in layer 4, which get the direct thalamic input. And this just shows the distribution of our recordings is mainly in layer 2, 3, and 4. And then we target three cell types. One of them is the pyramidal cell, and these are identifiable under IRDIC. And then we also record from these fast spiking cells, and we use the mice that cause these cells to fluoresce with GFP so we can identify them precisely. And then we also record from these other interneurons, which are more heterogeneous, so just to be on the safe side, I'm just going to call them non-fast spiking cells to distinguish them from the fast spiking cells. They differ in their morphology and also in their firing patterns. Okay, so the first step is to characterize the synaptic connections between the cells. So what we do is we record from up to 4 cells in a slice. So we're recording from primal cells here and an interneuron. And then we stimulate one of the cells with current pulses, evoke action potentials, and then we monitor the membrane potentials in the other cells. So that one has no response. And once in a while, we'll get synaptic input. We'll evoke a synaptic response in one of the cells. And now we can measure the EPSP amplitudes as well as the dynamics. In this case, it depresses. Then we can also do the same thing for inhibitory cell and record the IPSPs into the cell. And so this is a summary of the data. This is between the pyramidal to pyramidal cells. And EPSPs are relatively small. It's about 500 microvolts. And then most of them are depressed. This is the change in the PSP amplitude as a function of stimulus pulse. And these are for the other pairs. This is pyramidal to the fast spiking, the interneuron. And this is a pyramidal to the non-fast spiking. Notably, this EPSP is depressed here. And in a large population of the non-fast spiking cells, the EPSPs facilitate. And then we can also measure the inhibitory responses evoking pyramidal cells from the fast spiking and the non-fast spiking cells. The thing I want to point out is that the EPSPs are generally fairly small, except for the connections between the pyramidal and the fast spiking cells. These are they're almost 3 times as big as the EPSPs between pyramidal cells. The other thing is that the inhibitory inputs from the fast spiking cells are also much bigger than inhibitory inputs into the non-fast spiking cell.
I tried to find it, but do you have some data about the connection from the fast spiking to the cells and from the fast spiking to the non-fast spiking?
I have data from fast spiking to fast spiking.
And?
I'll show that to you. We don't have much, but I'll show you what I have. Okay, so from this we can get an idea of the amplitudes of the different potentials and also the dynamics. And then the other thing we want to do is figure out the connection probability between the cells as a function of distance. So what we do is whenever we do recordings, we just measure the distances between the cells and then document whether or not there was a connection. And then from this we can measure the connection probability as a function of distance. So this is a compilation of many data sets. And in each case, the postsynaptic cell was here in the center. These gray dots are all the cells that we sampled in the periphery. And the blue dots are where we found connections. And from this, we can then plot probability of connections as a function of the intersemantic distances.
Is there no dependence on the cell type?
There is. Right there. Okay. So these are the connection probabilities between the different cell types. Between pyramidal cells, pyramidal fast spiking, non-fast spiking, and in the other direction. And this is fairly consistent with Massimo's data in that the excitatory connections, actually most of the connections go to zero within 200 to 300 microns from the center. The important thing to note here is that the connection probability between the pyramidal cells is pretty low, like 0.07. And the largest connection probabilities are between the pyramidal cells and the fast spiking and in the other direction.
Have you tried other slice orientations?
No.
And this is all the one that preserves the photonic input?
Yeah.
What does this spatial scale compare to the octave scale? So, how wide is this curve relative to the tuning curve of the cell?
I haven't been able to figure that out. I mean, you have to measure the. It's hard to. People draw these figures where there's like tonotopic spots, but it's really continuous. So the cell will respond to different input if you increase the intensity. It's something I've been meaning to do, but I keep forgetting to do it. It should be easy to do. Just measure the extent of the cortex, and we know what the low and high frequency is, so we should be able to figure out the gradient.
So I didn't see any failures in your traces. Were there zero completely
failures? Zero.
Connected
there? Yeah. Most of these inputs, especially the parameter fast-packing cells, they make several connections into one cell, so it's hard to see. It's hard to see failures in single axons.
Maybe back to Ben's question. Mm-hmm. When you make this slice, what's the cortex look like in terms of its, how far down do the axons go? What's the angle relative to the radial width of the cortex? Because you've done this angle, right? So in a coronal slice, you may be, getting them sort of a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. But we do have a percentage of the slice of the axons and dendrites being cut. And so we did some controls for that. But so these are probably underestimates of the probability. But the relationship between the different cell types is maintained.
But just in terms of the angle, your slice preserves the tonotopic map within the slice.
Right, yeah. In theory, yeah.
And how thick are the slices?
It ranges from 400 to 500 microns.
Is there any difference between the depressing and the facilitating cells?
Yeah, the depressing ones are mainly from, the interneurons are the fast-spiking cells.
But you have the same cell, right? The non-fast-spiking cells that were both depressing cells and...
Yeah, it's heterogeneous. So,
you could imagine a situation where they would be recruited in different circumstances, so maybe that's
different. Yeah, that's one of the goals here we're trying to.
So, intuitively weighted integral under these curves gives the total number of connections per neuron, which is pretty different. Is that because they actually are different, or because a lot of the projections are outside the slice? Maybe it's not a relevant question.
No, it is different. Maybe across the cell types?
Yeah.
Yeah, it is different. So, the control would be to compare like the pyramidal and pyramidal fast spiking. They're all within the same area. And so if it was, if the axons are being preferentially cut in one and the other, then it should be.
That's my question. Yeah, so my sort of zero sort of view of the cortex is most neurons have about the same number of connections. So here it'd be very different. Is that because there are a lot of Pyramidal have a lot of long range, and you're not counting?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, this is strictly local. Okay. Obviously, we're not going to count the axons that go to other parts of the cortex. That's a good point. Okay. All right, so again, just want to point out the connection between pyramidal and fast spiking cells is fairly big in both directions. Okay, so now, this is to David's question. We just started collecting data between fast spiking and fast spiking cells, and connection probability looks like it's fairly small. It looks pretty small, and the other thing is they also have gap junctions that we're trying to deal with. Okay, so now we have the EPSP and IPSP amplitudes. We have the connection profile. Next step is to put it into a model.
Mm-hmm. Did you see reciprocal connections between the E and I cells?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's quite frequent. Okay, so now the next step is to incorporate this into a simulation, mainly to improve our intuition of how these neurons should interact. And the full model has three cell types. As the pyramidal cells, the fast spiking, and the non-fast spiking cells. And then for these, we use the adaptive exponential integrate and fire neurons. And so the advantage of that is that you can adjust the parameters so that it kind of resembles the firing patterns of the cells. And unlike full Hodgkin-Huxley models, it's actually quite fast. And then the connections between the cells are determined by the connection profiles, probability profiles, and then we use the synaptic parameters to model the connections between the cells. This is a simplified view. The full network is actually a sheet of neurons. It's about 10,000 cells. 10% are fast spiking, 10% are non-fast spiking. I'm trying to maintain a density, preserve the density that was in three dimensions.
So the reason why you chose 10,000 is the minimum study.
I did it in MATLAB, and that's the maximum I could do. At severe memory. Well, you know, I should rewrite it. But.
How many connections per neuron?
On the average, it's determined by this this profile here. So, I don't know. It's between primal cells, 0.1 times whatever the area of this Gaussian is.
What was the size of that sheet? Might have said that. Oh, 740.
Yeah. It corresponds to a 3D cortical cube that's 200 microns in thickness. Okay, so now once we have that, we assume that there is a input from the thalamus here. And
so with that input, is the network dead quiet?
Yeah.
Your brain like that?
My simulation is.
No, I think in vivo, layer 4, it's...
No, we can add noise to it eventually. In fact, we do in the later simulation when we do the mean field. And it shows pretty much similar results. Okay, so the thalamic inputs.
You really aren't going to get to the end of your talk.
No, I will.
This 750 microns here, is that, how does that compare with the total size of
the cortex?
Of auditory A1?
A1? I'd have to look it up. Maybe it's 1 or 2 millimeters. I really would have to look it up because I don't remember the numbers. Okay, so now we just kind of model the thalamic cell firing. It's just a series of spikes. It's just fire repetitively, introduce some jitter in the onsets and in the spike, and in spike times. And then this is just a PST, you can't see it probably, it's PSTH of these of the spikes. And we made it so that it's slightly phasic tonic, and this is based on the few recordings that has been made in these thalamic cells.
Is it Poisson distributed, this input spectrum?
No, I didn't make it Poisson because neurons are not Poisson. So
you tried to reproduce the statistics of the anti-spike interval.
Yeah, well, I mean, we don't have any data on it, so it's just...
You have jitter just during the spikes?
Yeah, jitter in the onsets and in the inner spike intervals. In fact, I did do Poisson, and it's pretty similar results, too. It was just easier for me to model the synaptic dynamics using...
And the input goes to all the channels?
Yeah, okay, so the input is Gaussian distributed so that cells in the center receive the most inputs. Okay, so A is the number of thalamic inputs. And the synaptic inputs from the thalamus to these different cell types were kind of determined from our lab and from other work. So the thalamic inputs into the primal cells and the fast spiking cells are depressing. And so this generates mainly a phasic responses in these cells. The inputs into the non-fast spiking cells is, you can't see it, it's facilitating. This is worked by Tan et al. And so these cells tend to fire tonically. Okay, so now we have this, and the way we're going to mimic the changes in the external environment is just by changing the parameters of this Gaussian. So we can change the number of thalamic inputs this cell gets. So this would be equivalent to increasing the intensity of the tone. And then we can also just vary the width of the Gaussian. And then we can look at how it affects the firing of the cells. Okay, so this is the main results here. And again, we're feeding this input into the three cell types here. And and just to remind you that cells in the center gets the most input in a Gaussian distributed way. And then this is the dot rasters of the primal cells, FS cells, and non-fastbacking cells. Okay, so the primal cells both the primal cells and the fastbacking cells tend to fire phasically, and that's because the thalamic inputs are depressing, and non-fastbacking cells are more tonic. The firing of the primal cells depends not only on thalamic inputs, but it's also determined by the feedback from the fastbacking cells and the non-fastbacking cells, and also amongst itself. Okay. And what we're really interested in is to figure out the spatial temporal profiles of the inputs into the primal cells. So we're going to do this across time and across cells. And do that, maybe the best way to start is to create a contour plot of the synaptic inputs into the primal cells. That's Mount Shasta in three dimensions. There's this contour, and there's the contour of the thalamic inputs into the primal cells. Okay. There's the contour plot of the input, the recurrent connections from the primal cells. So it's on after a certain delay. And then this is the contribution of the FS cells onto the primal cells. It's mainly transient. And there's the contribution of the, let's be some better way to do this, of the non-fast spiking cells onto the primal cells. Okay, so let's look at it across time. We're just going to focus on the cell here in the center. So just taking a slice through these contour plots. And that's what it looks like. Okay. It's and so what you can see is that the thalamic input appears first, and then the inhibitory from the fast spiking cells comes in, and then these little guys are just from the recurrent excitation and the inhibition from the non-fast spiking cells. It's a little disappointing because really the only thing that's interesting is in the first 100 milliseconds. After that, there's really no major changes. And if you look at the firing rate of the cells, you can see that there's initial excitation, and this inhibition carves out a trough in the firing response. And afterwards, the cell just fires very sparsely. And that's because the thalamic inputs is depressing. Okay. And if you compare this to the thalamic inputs, which is more tonic, and so the response in the cortex becomes more phasic. And this is in line with in vivo recordings by Creutzfeldt. Did some incredible studies where they record simultaneously from thalamus and in the cortex, and they show that two cells were connected to each other. And so the thalamic inputs is more tonic, and then the cortex is more phasic. Okay. Mm-hmm.
How come the second bump is so large in response?
This one?
Yeah.
So let's see. So I think if I took out the inhibition, this bump, this will actually go like this. So it'll get filled in by the. So this is really being carved out from this this inhibition here. Okay. So the. Next question then is, how does this look like in cross neurons? We're just going to take a slice through here. And this is the width of the thalamic input into the network. And these are the spatial profiles of the of different components. This is for a relatively broad input. If you make the input narrow with the same amplitude, you can see all of the components are reduced. The inhibition is reduced. Intuitively, is when you apply a narrow input, you activate fewer of the inhibitory cells, and so you would expect the inhibition to be smaller.
For the depression, you use the Markov circuit for it?
Yeah. Is there a better one?
Last week there was discussion about. Oh.
I wasn't here, unfortunately. Okay, and this just shows the change in the inhibition, all the components as a function the width of the input. So the when an input is narrow, inhibition is small because you're recruiting a few of these inhibitory cells. And as you increase the width, the inhibition actually increases. Okay, so this is the main finding. It was kind of surprising when it first started out, and then I'll show you it's actually almost embarrassingly trivial, but I'll go ahead and show it anyway. So if you present a thick input into the network, these are the profiles that you get. Now, to determine whether or not the excitation and inhibition are co-tuned, you just sum up the excitatory and inhibitory, and then normalize. So in this case, excitation and inhibition are co-tuned. Okay. Now, when the input is narrow, what you can see is that the inhibition is actually broader than excitation. So in this case, it's lateral inhibition. Okay. So basically, then, just by changing the width of the input, keeping the network the same, you can have both configurations. And what's plotted here is just the ratio of the width of the inhibition over width of excitation as a function of sigma. And so you have a region where the ratio is greater than 1. So this is lateral inhibition. And then it decays towards the co-tuned network. Okay.
Does this look similar during the second bump of activity?
Second bump of activity. Yeah, I think so. Well, no, it should change slightly because you're activating more of the inhibition. It won't change that much. The general relationship will still be maintained. Okay, so this is nice. Is it functional? And the easiest way to test this is to do something analogous to this sideband suppression. And what you do here is you stimulate the network with one input. This would be represent one tone. And then you present a second tone at different distances from the center. and then you measure the firing response of the cells. So here is for a lateral inhibitory network. And this represents the response to the one input. And then as you present the second input simultaneously, you get a peak here. And then as you move the Gaussian away from the center, you can see a clear suppression here. You don't see this with a co-tuned network. You can see that the firing just approaches the response to a single cell. So it's functional. You guys are pretty quiet today. Really?
So the inhibition comes with a little delay relative to the thalamic input. And in the regime where it's the lateral inhibition, you may therefore expect to see a sharpening of the tuning during the first 2 milliseconds of the response. Is that true?
Yes, I think that's true. Yeah. I have to at least based on the previous simulations that we did and that was published.
So when does the parameter scale then fire strongest? During the early period when the inhibition is still weak and then tuning is slightly wider, or during the later period?
The inhibition would have an effect on during a later period, more of an effect, but also affects the...
Also the thalamic input would be bigger then. And so it may be possible that the cell actually fires more when it's tuned more narrowly.
Fires more.
Because the thalamic input, if I remember correctly, also increases the
oxygen. Yeah, I suppose it might be a regime where that would occur. To check. Okay, so next is just to explain why this happens. And the best way to do this is just to simplify the model a bit. So this is the full network. And these are the different components. And then we're just going to say that these guys are really, really small. So we're just going to ignore them. And this it really simplifies this network a bit. So it becomes more of a feed-forward.
Can you just go back a slide? Just wanna... So in that top right configuration,
What happens when you vary the intensities of the two inputs?
What happens to this? I'll show it to you. You mean the on the firing or on this?
On everything. Yeah. You vary the vary the intensity of the stimulus one and cross that with various intensities of stimulus two.
Yeah, I haven't completed that because I was trying to. It'd be like equivalent to reconstructing the tuning curves, right, of the cells.
Well,
intensities and the. I haven't. I've started that. I haven't completed it.
I'm asking for a specific reason. I want to know how it shifts. You'll get something like a monotonically increasing, response with intensity stimulus one. And then when you superimpose stimulus two and the flanking positions, what does it do to it?
Yeah. I don't know.
Does it track? Does it divide? Does it scale down? Does it scale right?
So just keep the intensity of one constant, and then increase in
visual cortex. We measure a contrast response function to one stimulus, and then see how that's affected by as a function of the contrast.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. Okay, so we're just going to simplify this now. Just take out these connections, the spurious connections, because it's small anyway. So David, this is why I'm pushing for a feed-forward network. And this just reduces to just a simple feed-forward configuration. And now the analysis is really quite simple. And so you have a Gaussian input from the thalamus, and the pyramidal cells just inherits it directly because there's no recurrent connections. There's no other source of excitation into the pyramidal cells. The inhibition, it has to go to the inhibitory neuron, so you have to run this input through an FI curve. And then and then you get the firing rate profile as a function of distance. And then you take this and you convolve it with the connection probability between inhibitory cells and the pyramidal cells. And a couple more steps later, you end up with the inhibitory profile. Okay. Now you just use this algorithm, and just change the A and sigma. calculate the excitatory inhibitory inputs, and then measure the widths, and then just plot it as a function of sigma and A, and you have this surface that looks like this. Okay, so there's a region where this ratio is greater than 1, so it's lateral inhibition. Then it drops towards perfect co-tune, and then in this region, it's slightly excitation is slightly broader than inhibition. In this regime here, excitation is much broader than inhibition because inhibitory cells are not fully engaged yet.
Is it because of the dynamics of the synapse?
No, it's just the inhibitory cells are not fully activated. When the thalamic input is small. Okay, so you have lateral inhibition, perfect co-tuning, and close co-tuning. And the reason this occurs is actually quite simple. And the best way to see this is just to remove the threshold here, and now just feed in a so now when you remove the threshold, the firing rate profile of the inhibition just equals the firing rate profile of the thalamus. Now if you feed in a narrow input here, excitation is just inherited from the thalamus, and then you run it through this linear input-output curve, and see this, the firing rate profile is also narrow. You convolve it with the connection probability, and now it's broad. Now, if you just put in a broad input and run it through, it's going to be slightly broader, but relatively less. And it's just a high school math proof to show that in the limit, the two Gaussians are actually converge, and this is what you'd expect. So, there's still a region of lateral inhibition, but if you increase sigma, it should all converge to one. The importance of the threshold, however, is that it makes this transition within the physiological range, and I'll show you some data from the literature of the axonal width and the and compared to the axonal width of the inhibition. And it's really within this range here.
Well, I'm not clear. The difference between the inset and the main figure is just whether you have a threshold or not?
Yeah.
Alex? Mm-hmm. So I'm actually now confused. So what is it in the experiments you started with, in your examples that you started with, that varied the width of this thalamic input? I was under the impression when you were starting that with the same stimulus condition, that would mean the same thalamic input, you can get this heterogeneity of behavior in cortex.
Yeah, yeah. I'll show you in the next slide, in a few slides. But you know, you can imagine when you, you know, the basal membrane, if you increase the, if you present a tone, it activates a small region of it. And then if you increase the tone intensity, it increases the firing of this cochlear cell, but it also spreads out.
Okay, so but that means that you should see all of the neurons in cortex, either in one regime or in another regime, not a heterogeneity of responses to the same stimulus.
Well, I mean, it's in vivo, so, you know, you don't have control over all your parameters.
In the original experiments you were talking about.
Yeah, in the introduction.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm going to propose that either the axons are different into the cells, the spatial spread, or the animals are just in different states. It's you know, when you can modulate the different configurations, it's not too hard to imagine you know, different states will generate different widths of inputs into the cortex.
At the same time.
Yeah.
Same stimulus.
Yeah. Okay, so now you can also calculate the change in inhibition and excitation in this using that algorithm. And I guess the interesting thing here is that you know, this, people talk about a balanced state, but when you really define it, it's really hard to achieve. Basically, it's where this gray and the red curves intersect. It's where the perfectly balanced excitation and inhibition takes place. And this curve here is relatively steep, and so any change in the stimulus is going to put it in the unbalanced regime. But the only point I want to make here is that as you increase sigma and A, the inhibition increases.
What do you mean by perfectly balanced?
Like the excitation and inhibition in, let's say, in current are the same.
It's not exactly what the balanced regime means.
Well, it depends on what...
It's straightforward, so...
I mean, it's a balance in conductance, or I'm being very strict with the definition, but from the literature, it's pretty loosey-goosey as far as I can tell. If you do it in conductance, then the currents are never in balance.
I think Carl has a clear definition.
What is the definition?
Well, no, the problem is that you cannot give a clear definition for a finite size network. I mean, the definition is clear if you consider how the activity, or if you consider how things change when you take larger and larger networks with more and more connections. The sort of loose definition, which by definition has to be sort of fulfilled, is that the distance between the mean input and the threshold should be of more or less the same as the size of the fluctuations in the input, which is basically another way of saying that you have irregular activity with rates which are not crazy.
I have to think about that.
I'd say there's one more thing, Carl, and that is if you kill the inhibition, the neuron would fire like mad, and if you kill the excitation, the neuron would be dead quiet.
Yeah,
so that's sort of that gets the largeness thing, and then.
Right.
So if you have those two things, I'd say it's, for all intents and purposes, given that k is not really infinity. But.
Well, that's. I mean, there's proportional and there's balanced.
No, they don't have to actually. They don't have to be proportional.
Okay.
Which, I mean, they tend to be experimentally, but that wasn't necessarily a prediction of the theory, was it? Depends sort of what you vary, but it wasn't necessarily a prediction.
Okay.
So you assume that the excitatory, the probability of connection between excitatory and inhibitory cells, what kind of, just a probability, there is no correlation. But for example, Silberzer and Markram, when they looked at this connection, I mean, it was in layer 5. I mean, when two cells are excitatory connected, they are much more likely to be inhibitory connected. And when so these probabilities are not independent, so that the strength of inhibition would actually be much very different from this.
Yeah, I haven't looked at that. I have to check the numbers, whether it's going to play a significant role in this. No, I haven't done that yet.
It's a different layer. Yeah.
Okay. okay, so now we can use these surfaces and maybe try to reconstruct some of the response patterns that's been observed in vivo. And basically, when you change the stimulus, it creates a trajectory in these surfaces, and you should be able to predict how the excitation inhibitions are going to change, and subsequently how the firing of the cells are going to change. And to do this, we need an equivalent surface for firing rate. And there are many ways to do this. You can do the standard Monte Carlo simulations with integrated fire cells. You can use rate models. and the way we did it was kind of weird, but we used the mean field approximation. I won't go into this, but the from the Fokker-Planck, this is used to describe Brownian motion. It's kind of cool that you can apply it to the behavior of the network as well. But the main advantage of this is that over the Monte Carlo simulations is that it's much faster, and you get smooth curves. The main advantage over this over rate models is that you don't have these funky excitatory and inhibitory time constants, which are very hard to define, because the single cell dynamics is just incorporated into the Fokker-Planck equation.
In the model representation of the rate model, the time constant or the time constant of the synapses, according to the work of Oren Schrick and David and Heinz and Polinsky. So in this case, you have the right time scale.
Well, I mean, the time scale also depends on the integration of the of the synapses, right? That's the way that the network is recruited is incorporated into the time constant.
The synaptic time constant, the rise time of the amp, or the decay time of the amp, IPSP. The rise time of the IPSP or the decay time of IPSC.
No, but the firing of this of the individual cells also depends on the activation of the network, and that has its own time constant.
They're consistent with it, but the way I understand this is that in the rate model, for the steady state, you have the proper dynamics of the convex-based model. Of course, if you talk about dynamics, then there's a difference.
Yeah. The interesting part is in the first 100 milliseconds, right? So we wanted to, I mean, we could probably use it. I think it would generate the same results. It's just, I spent my sabbatical learning this, so I had to use it.
The parameters here, A, it is A.
A, here, yeah, that's the, like, the charge, the kick size of the...
Yeah.
I have other slides I can show you. So, so this is the output of this simulation. So this is X, and so these are the primal cells. This index is the primal cell location, and this is time. And this is the synaptic input into the primal cells. And this is the firing rate of the primal cells. So here, you can see that initially, it's mostly excitation from the thalamus, and then inhibition kicks in, and it carves out a trough in the input. And then the firing rate profile looks like this. So from here, if you look at this a steady state, you can make out a Mexican hat in this instance. And then here, if you take a slice to the center, this would be equivalent to the stimulus time histogram of a neuron here in the center.
So did you also neglect the GEE connections, the excitatory to excitatory?
Yeah, strictly so feedforward.
In the plots you showed that the contribution of the different curves, they didn't have an initial very big peak due to this background excitation?
No, it's really small.
In the profile of the current, there was a big initial peak.
That was the inhibition.
Dynamic input.
Yeah, dynamic input. And then the inhibition afterwards. Okay, so from this, you can reconstruct the surface, the ratio of inhibitory over excitatory widths, and it's pretty similar to the toy model. And then here, I chose to plot the peak of the peak firing of the central neuron, but you can also do it for the average firing rate. Yeah. Okay, so now, I'll just point out here that the firing rate is greater here when sigma is small because there's less inhibition. And as you increase the sigma, the firing rate actually decreases. So it's a nice surface. Okay, so now we can play around with this. And let's say in real life you have, you're varying some stimulus and you're measuring the firing rate. Okay, and it may be two things happening. You may change the number of inputs into the network, or you might also change the width. Let's just vary the, assume that when you change the stimulus, only the amplitude increases and the width doesn't change. Okay, so you have a family of Gaussians that look like this. And then when you trace it into these surfaces, those are the trajectories, and the firing rate is actually monotonic. Now let's take the other extreme and say that when you change the stimulus, the amplitude doesn't change, but now the input gets broader. And this traces a trajectory along there. And now, actually, you have a decrease in the firing rate. Okay, this is tempting to think that this might underlie this, at least partially underlie this observation in visual cortex, where you increase the diameter of the stimulus, the firing rate actually decreases. The difference is that the network here is actually changing from LIN to CON as you go along the surface. That's something that I have a rotating student now who's going to explore this more carefully. And then what's probably happening, and then if you assume that with both of them changed, then the trajectory is more diagonal. And you get a different rate level function curve. Okay. All right. So now, to reproduce these, we can assume then, or we can propose, that this is starting more here in the CON regime, and this non-monotonic is here in the LIN regime. And if you plot the trajectories like that, and you can see one is monotonic and the other one is non-monotonic. And this becomes more extreme if you do this for the average firing rate surface rather than the peak firing rate. And then this two-tone suppression, I already showed you that you can produce it in depending on whether you're in the LIN or the CON regime. And the different firing rates, remember some of them fire tonically, some of them fire phasically. Again, you can get different firing responses depending on where you are on the surface. So in the lateral inhibitory regime, you can get more of a tonic response. And then as you get to the co-tune regime, you get more of a phasic response. Okay. So it reproduces nicely all of the different firing patterns that's been observed in cortex. Okay, so what is the functional implication of this? Is this even feasible? And the way we kind of look at this is do the literature search. And so we basically want to know what the extent, physiological extent of the axonal arbors of the inhibitory cells and the extent of the thalamic inputs into the same area. And fortunately, there's been some studies in the barrel cortex. So this is a typical cell, in inhibitory cell in the barrel cortex. And these are the distribution of the individual thalamic afferents that's been documented. Okay, and they vary quite a bit. So one is here is about 0.15 millimeters and ranges to almost a millimeter. Okay. And that's just shown here. So what this means then is that the width of the axons of the inhibitory is determines this, and the width of the thalamic afferents roughly determines the width of the input into the network. And the input is quite variable, and so it would put this roughly, the functional range, to be right about here, right on the cusp of the transition between lateral inhibition and co-tuning. And
everyone, so you make the assumption that sort of the authorization for the phosphoryking and non-phosphoryking inhibitory cells are the same?
Non-phosphoryking cells don't contribute much, at least in this model. Okay. So just took it out.
So basically, the thalamic input goes from about one-third the inhibitory range to about three times the inhibitory range.
Yeah. I mean, it's not quite right, because you have to do like a convolution of the, yeah, of the afferents. But, you know, it's only within range. It's not in the...
I want to ask you again about how the different behaviors can coexist.
Okay, so...
But this is a good place to do it. So the thalamic inputs can be narrow or they can be wide.
Yeah.
In your model simulations, though, either all of the pyramidal cells and all of the inhibitory interneurons receive narrow input, or all of them receive broad input, okay? So for these things to coexist, you still have the multiplexing problem that you started off with.
Yeah.
You have to have a subset of the neurons, have a subset of the pyramidal cells and a corresponding subset of the interneurons that are receiving narrow input.
Yeah.
And a separate subset of the pyramidal cells and corresponding interneurons that are receiving broad input.
Yeah, I mean, it's an in vivo recording, so you have a lot of, there's a lot of variables that you're not really measuring. So it might be you measure the cells, you measure the cells at different times, the condition of the animal might be slightly different.
Okay, that's true. But that just argues that you should do, that those experiments should be redone with a Utah array or something, and a tetraode, or, you know, record from a bunch of neurons at once to the same stimulus,
yeah,
and see if you see the diversity of physiology, if that's, you know.
That would be one prediction, yeah.
So, along those lines, your model would predict that the neurons that have the flanking inhibition would have a very narrow excitatory
right
range.
Yep.
Is there any way to support that?
Well, we would like to.
Data or.
We don't.
In those neurons, is the excitatory range narrower than what you see on average, or do you have to go do additional experiments where you do intracellular recording?
You have to do intracellular recordings in vivo, and let me just go to the conclusions so I can explain a bit. So the implication here is that if you have a population of cells and the afferents into it are fairly narrow, it will produce LIN-based coding. Okay, so maybe an example would be like the parvocellular and magnocellular inputs into the visual cortex, where the magno is much broader than the parvo, and so they would produce very different sets of responses. Okay. Then the other possibility is that this is what I'm trying to use an argument against David, is that maybe the animals are under certain conditions, the input is more confined, so you're recruiting less of the thalamic afferents, and then in other conditions, it's actually broader. And so it allows you some flexibility into the response of the cells. So unless you can control for the state of the animal, it might be that the responsive cells are inherently heterogeneous.
So the co-tune really represents sort of an amplitude signal, and the LIN input represents more of a positional, fine-tuned.
Well, both can code amplitude.
Well, there's more of a tilt towards amplitude with the co-tune, and more of a tilt towards discrimination with the.
Yeah, I mean, in some sense, the LIN is like an intensity it says like intensity tuning because the FI curve of the response stimulus curve has a peak, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Centers around.
Center, yeah.
So I guess you have no good anatomical information on the variance in the anatomical properties of the neurons within cortex.
The thalamic actions?
No, the neurons in the cortex, not the thalamic actions.
Neurons, say it again.
So the different types of neurons that you look at in the cortex should also have some variance in their range of connections. But I suppose you do not have good anatomical data on that.
Yeah, we do. We reconstruct the cells and.
So have you put this variance also in your model?
No, because the connection profile you would predict based on the convolution of the axons and dendrites. I guess I can show it. It matches the connection probability.
If you would do this, is it possible that you may simply by chance get some cells that show more Lin type behavior and other cells that show more Con type behavior based on the
anatomy?
On the connections, yeah.
I don't think so. I mean, that's really determined by the connection probability. I mean, the axons and dendrites might extend further out, but the connection probability tells you whether or not they're connected.
No, but presumably when the dendrites spread farther out, you have some broader. You'd have to presumably then also the connection probability would be broader, right?
Yeah, but we measured it, so it's.
Right, but you measured
on specific cell types.
Population average, right? So.
I see. You mean I suppose. But how do you define connection? Yeah, I have no choice.
if you have a million cells, which probably you don't, right? So you can separate your cells in ones with narrow.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that if you do that, you'd get different connection probability for a different class, subgroups.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah.
Now,
I just I don't have the manpower for that.
But you could make a guess. You could say, okay, what you get is the evolution between the width of the arborization and the probability that synapses end up,
for those to make a difference, it has to be a substantial, substantial number.
Yeah.
I don't know.
You could make some guess about how big a contribution this should be.
Yeah, I could. Yeah, I guess. Yeah, I mean, I guess you can separate out the. you can reduce it.
So you could make some guess about how much you would expect this to contribute to the heterogeneity.
Yeah, we can do that. We can separate out. We can reconstruct cells and then just parse out the ones with big dendrites and small dendrites, and then the just calculate just do a convolution of the axons and dendrites and make a prediction about. Yeah, we can do that. I can't do it.
I'm saying something, but what do you know about the width of the tuning of the thalamic nucleus themselves? Is there much variability in this?
The width of the.
Does the breadth of the broad input necessarily come from contact with many LGN, many thalamic inputs, or do you have a wide variety of breadth of tuning of the LGN?
No, that's a good idea. I mean, there's not much data on that. But I should look at the old papers, see if I can confine the distribution a bit more. Yeah.
It's good to hear that they all have the same tuning. And,
yeah. Yeah, that's a good idea. Okay, so these are the main conclusions. Co-tuning and classical lateral inhibition exists in the same network. It's not hardwired, which is kind of cool. You can put the network in different states just by changing the input width. you can account for many heterogeneous stimulus response functions. And my guess is based on the recordings we did in somatosensory cortex, that this applies also into other systems. And just thank Robert Levy, who did most of the back-breaking, painstaking experiments to figure out the connection probability. Okay. Thanks. I break a record.
It's just about the different probabilities for connections. You said that you have reciprocal connections. Do you also look for triangles, for loops, which have three of them? Can you identify those?
No, we have the data, but we haven't looked at that yet. Yeah, it's just another level of complexity that to incorporate into the model. I don't know if it's going to have much of an effect unless it has it's represents significant percentage of the connections.
Could add a lot to the computation of the network.
Yeah, I suppose.
What would you look at to find the signature of the impact of the connections? For what you were interested from this presentation?
What would I do to test it?
Yeah, but what would be a signature that they're there?
You mean the different two configurations?
Your recurrent of connectivity, got lost for good reason.
Well, I mean, they're serving some other function, but I don't know. It's uh-huh. not for this, not for the layer 4 dynamically driven. And I strategically confine my input, my analysis, the first few milliseconds, 50 to 100 milliseconds, just so I can avoid the reviewers saying, well, what about the cortical, you know, cortical connections?
How sensitive was your simulation to whether the inputs were facilitating or depressing?
How
sensitive was your simulation?
I mean, the non-fast-spiking cells were facilitating, so it was in there, but it was fairly weak.
So you took them out completely?
I took them out. I mean, I should say that I probably did not investigate their function properly. Like Massimo said, it should be on the dendrites. The input should really be on the dendrites. So I would have to modify the model so it has two compartments to look at it fully. So that's a caveat for that.